On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doug Kirby.
We've got a really special Mother's Day show today, and you might find it kind of interesting. Usually we have nice books about mom, or we have self-help books, you know, that sort of thing. But no, this year, I had read this book earlier in 2024, and it really made a huge impact on me. The author is one of my really favorite fictional authors, Sarah Sundin, and she always does an incredible job with stories that are set during World War II. This time, it's not so much a woman in a situation, a man in a situation, they get together, the man's in the service. That is not the case in this book at all. It's very different, and that's what makes it so particularly appealing to me, especially for Mother's Day. The name of the book is Embers in the London Sky, and it's from our friends at Revel Books, which is a division, of course, of Baker Publishing Group. Sarah Sundin is the best-selling author of When Twilight Breaks, Until Leaves Fall in Paris, The Sound of Light, and the popular World War II series Sunrise at Normandy, among others. Christie Award winner and a Carroll Award winner, and novels are received. So with all of that said, Sarah, this is quite a remarkable book, even for you. This is something really special. So thank you so much for making time to talk to me today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Should we tell people a little bit about the story, and then you could tell us how you sort of got interested in the topic?
Oh, sure. Yes. Embers London Sky was inspired when I was actually doing research for my book, Until Leaves Fall in Paris, and I was reading about the exodus when the Nazis invaded France, and you know, millions of people were on the road trying to flee. And people were desperate, and some of these people who were on foot would take their children and thrust them into cars of complete strangers, believing that that child would stand a better chance in a car than they would on foot. But then as everything settled down and people were trying to get home, they couldn't find their children. And that broke my heart. And, you know, I'm a mother, I'm a brand new grandmother, and that just, you know, ripped my heart apart. Mm. And I thought, well, what would it be like if that happened to you as a mother? And so that inspired Embers in the London Sky. So she's Aleta Vanderzee. Martens is a Dutch refugee, and her horrible husband thrusts their little boy into the cars of a family bound for London, and that's all she knows. And then he's killed, and the husband is killed. So she's on her own. She makes her way to London, and all she knows is she has no photographs of him. She has nothing about this child to help her. So she enlists the help of BBC radio correspondent Hugh Collingwood, and they try to find this child. And meanwhile, they're there during the Blitz, and he's reporting on the Blitz, and there's a mystery, too.
Yes. Yes. Now, of course, there are all sorts of twists and turns in this, and I found that very interesting and very likely as well. The main character, male character, being a BBC correspondent, I just, of course, as a radio guy, I just loved that. And, uh-huh. And these guys were just extraordinarily courageous. It's hard for us in America to imagine what it must have been like to have your city bombed night after night after night after night. First by airplanes dropping bombs, and then by rockets being fired over. And mm-hmm. this went on for years. The people of London just stiffened up and put up with it, but it was not easy at all. And
no.
And those of you who have read the Chronicles of Narnia know that there were children in that were taken from London to the villages far away from London to try to make them safe. And so that's a part of this, too, that there are children in transit from one place to another, which makes it that much harder for Aleta Vanderzee Martens to find her missing son. And she volunteers with an organization, and she does not get a great amount of sympathy, weirdly enough, from the lady who's in charge. And that was interesting, too, because, of course, there would have to be some sort of registry keeping track of which child got sent to live in what village so that hopefully they could be reunited at some point.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And the thing was, it was all organized very quickly. It was within They've been putting some plans in place before the war broke out, but the whole evacuation took place over the course of a day or two. They evacuated 1.5 million children and mothers of young children in a day or two. Just phenomenal logistics. But the reality was, when they came to these villages and they dumped off these groups, you know, these whole schools would come together, and then they had to find housing for them. Since most of them were housed with their school, they were very well accounted for. But I just had an idea for her putting this registry together so there was a central way to locate the children.
I can't even imagine what it would be like to send your child away from home in the hopes that they'd be safer there, but not being really 100% sure. And would you ever get to see him again? Would how long is the war going to last? At this point, nobody really knows. And to think of all of the people that were refugees from one country or another, because there were so many countries that were being taken over by the Nazis, and therefore so many people fleeing, a lot of them end up in England because there's really nowhere else to go at this point.
Mm-hmm. England was really especially London was really a gathering place for people from all over the world at that point. There were so many refugees there. Really interesting stories of these exiles and how they made their way. And some of them were really welcomed, like the Polish pilots flew for the RAF. They were quite the heroes. And others, they weren't welcomed. If you think about it, this England, like the rest of the world, had just come out of the Great Depression. Jobs were scarce. Now the war's in place. Refugees were not the type of people they wanted in town because they had to care for them as well as themselves. They were losing housing due to bombing, and now they have to house all these refugees too. And so you throw in your usual anti-immigrant sentiment that is so common in every nation, and there were some problems for the refugees. And overall, they were treated fairly well, but there were definitely instances, and depending especially where you came from, too.
Yeah. And, of course, England, in America, we have race. That's been the issue we've dealt with all these years. But in England, it's class. And most of the people who are refugees, even if they had had money back home, when they get to England, they don't have any money. They're dirty and beat up and all of that. Kind of easy to say, well, who needs the riffraff?
And there was anti-Semitism, and a lot of these refugees were Jewish. So, you know, there were a lot of factors going on.
Yeah.
So, not to mention just the stress of being at war. So, when people are stressed, they react poorly. So, the fact that, you know, Londoners have this wonderful reputation of, you know, to keep calm and carry on. Mm-hmm. And in general, that really was. They really did keep that stiff upper lip and did their very best and still went to work, even though not sleeping all day and their houses getting bombed out. The cases of absenteeism did not rise during the war, during the Blitz. That's phenomenal. They really did make the best in a horrible situation.
By the way, in case you're late joining us today, we're talking to Sarah Sundin, who's been a guest on this show several times before, talking about her wonderful World War II novels. Her latest series is not really a series. They're not connected to one another. They're not a trilogy or anything like that. But they're all really fascinating and extraordinary and give us a chance to ponder what it would be like to be living in different nations in Europe as the Nazis draw closer or take them over. Again, America has been so blessed that we have not gotten that close to being conconquered ever. The name of the book is Embers in the London Sky, and it's from Revel. Sarah, the other main character in here, and both the main characters have flaws, of course, because we all have flaws. she is grimly determined to find her son, and he has a malformed hand. And this is one reason, apparently, her abusive husband didn't really care what happened to him, because he didn't really care for him much. I kind of get the feeling he really wouldn't have been all that unwelcome to the Nazis. He would have been a probably very likely to have been a someone who was an enabler for the Nazis in his country. I'm actually kind of surprised he was running away from them.
So yes, her husband, being a man of low morals, would have, and he loves money overall, so he probably would have done okay under the Nazis, but he believes that he will do far better in England, where he can conduct business in his own way. That's just what he believes. But
the fact that her son has a physical disadvantage, mm-hmm. is back in the 1940s. Yeah. There were plenty of people that thought that children who had any sort of thing that made them less than perfect, that they should just be sent off to a home or something, and that decent people wouldn't have to look at them.
Yeah.
Do you feel like any of that's going on with some of the people who are not particularly helpful to her?
Very possible. And this comes from my personal experience. My oldest son, the father of the grandbaby, by the way, was born missing his left arm below the elbow.
Wow.
And so when I found this out when I was still pregnant, and so being the person I am, I did a whole bunch of research into it. And one of the things that was striking to me was that for any sort of disability, the rates of divorce for the parents are much higher, and the rates of abuse for the child are much higher. Hmm. And that just was devastating to me, and I was looking at my little boy and loving him to pieces, and I'm blessed. My husband was when I called him, I was at the ultrasound place, and I called him and told him what was going on, and my husband skips a beat and he says, "The kid will live." I was crying. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
The kid will live. Like, yes, okay. Whew, deep breath. He's missing his arm, not his brain. He obviously he's done great in life. So my husband, never had a problem with it. And we just treated him like any other child, because that's what he is inside.
Sure.
And he's a wonderful young man now. But knowing how children with disabilities have been treated, especially historically, obviously our attitudes toward disabilities are much different now than they have been in the past.
Sure.
We're much more accepting of them. We're much more accommodating to those with disabilities. But there are still difficulties, and I see that. And it's something that they always have to live with. When my son was a school age, at one point, because his is very physical, you can see it. And he looked at me and he says, "Mom, I'm just tired of talking about it." Because everybody asks questions like, "What happened to your arm?" Yeah. And he just like, "I'm tired." And I said, "I understand, honey." And it's not going to get better. You're going to be asking, people are going to ask you that question pretty much every day for the rest of your life.
Yep, yep.
And there was just no way around that. So even when people aren't cruel, and even when they aren't abusive, it's very difficult to live with any sort of disability.
Yeah, so. So that made for a particularly intriguing insight, but as a good writer does, you also turn that into a strength.
Yes.
and that's of course what you do. Let's talk about the BBC guy for a minute, if that's okay. I find Hugh Collingwood very interesting, because he is from one of those families that has money. They are the landed gentry, and there are expectations that as he grows up, that he will behave a certain way, and that he will fill a particular role in the family history. And he's not particularly interested in that.
Yeah.
He has a talent and a skill, mm-hmm. But he also has a physical problem that he keeps hidden, because in those days it was still a huge problem. Do we want to reveal that problem? I mean,
I revealed in the second chapter, so it's okay. Yeah, he has asthma.
Yeah.
Back then, there weren't as many treatments for it, so it was more difficult to live with. And secondly, there was that sense of coddling. You don't let them play, don't let them get exposed to anything, and got to protect them. So that's how he was raised, extremely coddled. And he was a second-born child, so he kind of got away with things. And his big brother is going to fulfill the family obligations by being the star in society, and Hugh can kind of do his own thing. So he finds his way in reporting and then ends up on the radio and finds a spot. And for the first time, he's doing something that he's good at and he enjoys, and he's getting recognition for it, and he loves it. But when his older brother is killed, now he is the heir. And his parents believe that it's time for him to give up this nonsense, this frivolity that he's been engaging in, and do something appropriate. But he can't join the military because of his asthma, and that leaves the government, which he's not suited for.
Right. And
so he's, kind of, he's torn between wanting to not just please his parents, but honor them, which is a good thing to do, but also being true to how God made him. And with this talent and this gift, which he is using for a very good purpose. So that's a tension that he's dealing with throughout the story.
Now, there's another tension that he deals with, and this is a professional one. And this is another reason that this story really resonates with me, because I've been in radio when we were at war before. Not like him, don't get me wrong. But I've been in radio for 50-something years, and so because of that, I've been on the air during Desert Storm and all the years of the War on Terror. And there's always a delicate balance that you have to employ when you're in the media about talking about what's going on. How much do we dare criticize, say, a military branch of the government for poor management or poor leadership or so forth when they're busy defending you?
Exactly.
I'm reading a book on General Grant right now, and he came in for all kinds of criticism from the northern newspapers. Of course, the southern ones weren't crazy about him either, but the northern newspapers went after him all the time, and, of course, President Lincoln. But in the 20th century, there's been sort of sometimes subtle, sometimes not so subtle pressure that we don't tell the bad stories. He's trying to just tell stories, but he also is learning as he goes. And sometimes he says things on the air that he doesn't particularly think are going to be giving anything away to the enemy who might be listening in. But he gets called down for some report where they say, you told something on the air that you shouldn't have. If you'd been using a script instead of improvising, you wouldn't have made that mistake. You have to submit scripts from this point forward to me, and I will authorize them. Otherwise, you're out. And that's a tough gig.
It is. And the BBC, the thing that fascinated me when I was researching the BBC, and I really hadn't thought about it before, but World War II was the first war to be broadcast on the radio.
Yes.
World War I, radio stations weren't a thing.
Right.
So they are improvising radio broadcasting of a war for the first time. And so the difference is the newspapers, you have a different standard, but the radio, what they broadcast in London could be heard in occupied France. So the Germans would hear exactly what they were saying. So if they were reporting on the fair weather and the sunny conditions in Britain, then the Germans on the continent could say, oh, good. Good weather is coming our way. Great day to send over a bombing raid.
Yeah.
So what seems like an innocuous thing, they're just reporting on the weather. We all need to know the weather. For them, that was a military secret because they didn't know which way the weather. They knew which way the weather was coming, so they knew which weather was coming to them. So they weren't allowed to report on the weather during the war. And for example, if he was in the middle of a bombing raid and talks about, as he's reporting live, talks about a bomb falling on Trafalgar Square, the Germans could take that and say, oh, exactly at 9:59 p.m., a bomb fell on Trafalgar Square. We can adjust our navigation accordingly. And so what was accurate reporting could have been very dangerous military secrets to the Germans. On the other hand, the BBC got in trouble with the public very early because they were doing very generic, everything's fine, nobody's dying,
Right.
The bombing raid was not too bad, but people are living there. They're watching the bombs while they know it was bad. So there was a sense of, we can't trust the BBC. Then that actually creates really bad morale. So yeah. They had to walk that very fine line of, like, okay, we need to report truthfully, but we don't dare send anything that's going to aid the enemy. And so trying to find that balance, and not an easy thing to do. So I think they actually did a very good job. Everything I've read about the BBC, they found that balance, and they found it pretty early in the war.
Yeah, yeah. But it was tough. Mm-hmm. One of the strange little truths about the Pearl Harbor attack, for example, is that mm-hmm. the Japanese pilots
yep.
tuned to an AM radio station in Pearl Harbor mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. followed the signal in. And
yep.
for people who aren't technical, they don't understand how that could be. But just imagine that it's a homing beacon and you're following it yeah. in. So you know exactly where to go because you just exactly. follow the strength of the signal and you'll know you're headed to the right place. And that's mm-hmm. just a little example. You're right. Giving the weather, and we also in America tend to think of Europe as being really huge like the United States
yeah.
is. It's not. And because of that, it wouldn't be hard at all if you're sitting, especially if you're sitting in occupied France or occupied yep. Netherlands, to hear a weather report from London
yep.
And go, oh, yeah, let's adjust our invasion plans or let's adjust our – be sure to tell the pilots, hey, this is the situation.
Yep.
And the government always wants you to say, oh, it's swell. But see, this is what happened to – Germany in World War One and World War Two, that the whole time their mm-hmm. public relations of the government
yeah.
was saying, we're winning. And then when they didn't, people were shocked.
Yeah, so there's obviously you can go too far with that. So, and it was fun having Hugh play with those ethical choices. And he has a bunch of reporter friends and they get together and debate these things. And those were some fun scenes to write because they're, of course, reporters tend to be very intelligent and well-informed and very opinionated and outspoken. So those were some fun conversations to play with in my story and great personalities to play with, too.
Oh, absolutely. Well, and we should drop a hint here, not too much of a big one, but there are some murders that begin to occur
yes.
in the circle of Hugh Collingwood. So that's something that he's trying to figure out. And we should also mention, if they haven't figured out by now, that Hugh and this lovely widow lady who's looking frantically for her missing son become emotionally connected. Because she's a remarkable woman and he sees that. And he's a remarkable man, although he doesn't think he is. And she sees that.
I always have to have a romance. It just makes me happy. Yes,
yeah. Now, you got interested in World War II novels because you have family members, grandfathers, both of them, and yeah. a great uncle who were all involved yeah. in the war in one situation or another, right?
Yes, including one who was, we're talking about the navigation to Pearl Harbor. He was in a B-17 serving as a navigator flying into Pearl Harbor during the attack.
Oh, he was one of the ones that was on the unarmed yeah. B-17s that were coming in.
Yeah, there were 12 B-17s. He was on one of them.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
So he has stories.
Imagine how frustrating that would have been to be flying in and saying, they're attacking the base that we're trying to land on. Let's shoot them down. Oh, wait. We have no bullets.
We don't have guns. And they were running out of fuel.
Yeah.
And they had to find some place to land, and all the fields were shot up. So, yeah, they landed all over Hawaii.
Wow, well, I have read about that before, but wow.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, that's
amazing.
Yeah,
he was. And he went on and flew a combat tour from Australia in early 42, and then went back to the U.S., got some more training, and by then he was a full pilot and flew with the 8th Air Force in England and
wow.
ended up the lieutenant colonel in Eisenhower's headquarters. So he had quite a career.
Yes. Wow.
He's a storyteller, so I'm really blessed that he was a storyteller. My grandfather was a storyteller, so I benefited from hearing those stories.
Oh, indeed. I'll be honest with you, my late father-in-law fought in, he was an MP in Italy and France, and he never told his children thing until, I think it was my oldest son, his daughter's son, wanted to interview him, and he talked it to Sean, and we found out these things, but they never knew him before.
Yeah, most people, that was how they dealt. Most of the men, when they came back, I didn't realize this until I started writing these books and I started hearing from people. One of the most common emails I've received is, my family member served in World War II, and he never told, he could never tell his stories. So thank you for these books, because now I understand more about what he went through.
Yeah.
And that was stunning to me, because my family were storytellers. So that is how they coped. But that is a rare thing. That is not how most men came home, and like, they don't want to think about it. They definitely don't want to talk about it. That was how they coped with what they'd seen and what they'd done.
Right.
So my grandfather and great uncle were anomalies.
Yeah.
But I benefited from that, from hearing their stories.
Absolutely. And we thank you for telling the stories that you're telling. Sarah's newest book is Embers in the London Sky. It's from Revel Books, available. Check your local bookstores first through Baker Bookhouse and all the other online things. And people can contact you, right?
Yes, through my website, sarahsundin.com.
You can also look for on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. Sarah, thank you. It's always wonderful to get a chance to talk to you. I love your books. Whenever I see that a new one's coming out, I get excited, because I know it's going to be a wonderful read. And this one, they get stronger and stronger, and this one is really extraordinary.
Well, thank you so much.
Our thanks again to Sarah Sundin. Her latest book, Embers in the London Sky, from Revel Books, which is a division of Baker Publishing Group. And I didn't mention, as we were talking, and I should have done so, but her two main characters in this book, Hugh and Alita, are both people that are struggling with their faith in the midst of war and losses and chaos, but they ultimately put their trust in the one thing that doesn't change, and that's another reason that this makes a wonderful novel and a great read. So thanks so much for joining us today for a special Mother's Day program. We'll see you next time right here on your favorite radio station and your favorite podcast on thebookshelf.podbean.com. Until next time, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks again for listening, and God bless.